Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street in Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Today's show brought to you by Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury, Sunbury Motors Key, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. And our play-by-play call of the day down at the Pete in Pittsburgh last night, all Duke behind Zion Williamson.
Trying to drive inside is Tony. The pass was picked off by Goldwire, trying to kick it back up top. In transition, Goldwire, nice feed to Barrett. Down the lane, the Euro step. The layup, no, but the tap follow good from who else? Zion Williamson, and Jeff Capel has seen enough.
Well, so is all of college basketball, and they don't have to wait much longer. He is going to go into the NBA draft. I don't think we're really spoiling it for everybody by mentioning that, but he is something else. Zion Williamson. Reminds me a lot of Larry Johnson when he was at UNLV. Very pleased to be joined by the outstanding Tim Kirchin. Tim always is very generous with his time with us. Tim, I know you were in Williamsport recently. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, my pleasure. I had a great time in Williamsport, and I hope to come back next year for that event, but I'll definitely be back in August for the Little League World Series and the Major League Classic.
Well, this Hall of Fame ends up with some local roots, and it's more than just Roy Halladay being with the Phillies. But obviously, Mike Mussina, who's coaching basketball in his home, Montoursville. And the other part is that Braden Halladay signed his letter of intent to play baseball at Penn State in November. So there are a lot of local roots here. Your thoughts on those two men going in?
Well, Mussina should have been in on the first ballot, in my opinion.
I agree.
I voted for him every year. He won 270 games with a .638 winning percentage. Like 10 pitchers in history have both of those numbers. Pitching his entire career in the American League East in a DH league during the height of the steroid era and throw up those kind of numbers, especially in the postseason, to me warranted first ballot Hall of Fame induction. But he finally got in. Doesn't matter that it took this long. He finally made it, and very deservedly so. As for Roy Halladay, I'm thrilled that he got in the first year eligible again. Another guy with 200-plus wins, and in this case, a winning percentage of almost .660, which is ridiculously high. And his 10-year prime was, he was probably the best pitcher in baseball during that 10-year prime, and he was best at finishing what he started, which not many guys do today. He was a throwback on every level.
I remember when Penn State was getting ready to play Florida in the Outback Bowl. It was at the end of the 2010 season. It was the 2011 Outback Bowl. And Penn State was able to get an agreement with the Phillies to work out there. And I remember sitting down with Joe Paterno to do the pregame show. And before we did it, he looked at me and says, "You wouldn't believe who was out there almost every day." And he was the only guy there. It was Roy Halladay. And he commented what an awesome guy he thought Halladay was. Does that tip us off as the kind of work ethic that Roy Halladay brought to the table, that in late December he's the one guy that's down there working?
Absolutely. I remember going to do a story on him one day at Camden Yards when the Blue Jays were in. I walked in the clubhouse at 3:30 in the afternoon. Greg Zahn was one of their catchers at the time, said, "Who are you looking for?" I said, "I'm looking for Roy." He goes, "I got here at 1:30, Zahn said. "And he was in a pool of sweat when I got here. He said he's still working out. And he said, don't forget, he pitched last night." This is what Roy Halladay did every time he went out there, is he worked so hard so he could finish the game. He wasn't interested in striking everyone out. He was interested in pitching 9 innings. So one day I was told by Brian Schneider, one of his former catchers, that he came off the mound after 8 innings, and Charlie Manuel and Rich Doobie, the pitching coach, were there, hands extended, like, "Great job, Roy. We're going to let Brad Lidge pitch the 9th. Halladay shimmied right past both guys, never even acknowledged they were there, didn't say a word, went and sat in his seat in between innings, and they looked at him and basically said to themselves, well, I'm not taking him out. And the other thought, well, I'm not taking him out. So Roy Halladay went out and pitched the ninth inning because that's what he did, and that puts him in a different category than so many other pitchers in recent history.
When you look at the swing of Edgar Martinez, what did you see?
Well, I saw near perfection from the right side. Scott Bradley told me, Scott Bradley was one of his teammates and a really smart guy, now the baseball coach at Princeton, that Edgar's the best hitter he ever played with, better than Harold Baines, Mattingly, Ken Griffey Jr. Maybe not a better player, but a better hitter than those guys because his swing was so perfect. He could get to that ball on the inside part of the plate better than almost any right-handed hitter you'll ever see. His hands and forearms were so unbelievably strong. He was such a student of the game. And when Scott Bradley retired, he told me he asked the video coordinator with the Mariners to make him a tape of Edgar's beautiful swing and some of the highlight swings that he took. And then when Scott, and he put it to the music of Kenny G's beautiful saxophone, so it's this beautiful sax music with this beautiful swing. And Scott told me years ago that he used to, you know, put that tape in for his baseball team in Princeton and just tell everyone, sit down and take 7 or 8 minutes and look at the best hitter I've ever played with. That's who Edgar Martinez was.
Yeah, I thought he was the right-handed swing to Will Clark's left-handed swing. I mean, it's like, wow. What a great swing.
He was really good, and only the people who actually played with and against him can appreciate what a difficult out he was in this era where there's so many walks, so many strikeouts, so many home runs. He had more walks than strikeouts in his career, and that is just unheard of today.
And then there's Mariano Rivera, the first 100%er. Now, I'm still trying to figure out the nine that didn't vote for Hank Aaron, but that's all right. The first 100%er along the way. I mean, in an era where you had to throw all these different pitches, he did it with one pitch. When you look at Rivera, why was that one pitch so good?
Well, it had such late movement, and it had such incredible velocity when it was moving. Buck Showalter told me a story that they saw that his first year in pro ball. In fact, some guys would try to play catch with him, and they had trouble catching him because 10 feet before the ball actually arrived at the guy he was playing catch with, it just darted so quickly that people had trouble playing catch with Mariano Rivera. And he had that when he was 19 years old. So they just had to figure out, what are we going to do with this? Because he really didn't have another pitch. He didn't throw a curveball. He had a really stiff wrist. But he found a way, God-given way, to take that pitch and figure out what to do with it. And boy, did he ever, because he's the greatest closer of all time, and there is not even a close second.
And completely agree with that. Now, you released your ballot, and it was put on ESPN, so we know you voted for 10. And among the 10 you voted for were Barry Bonds, Roger Clemens, Gary Sheffield. What are your, you know, what are your cases on each? Because obviously the debate will be, okay, but Tim, and they'll bring up the PED part of it. What is your counter to that?
Well, it's not an easy decision. I'm not comfortable doing it. I'm not even suggesting it's right. It's just the best I can do under the circumstances. It just seems to me that at the time that those guys played, specifically Bonds and Clemens, there was this tacit agreement going on in Major League Baseball that nobody's checking on this. There's no suspensions from this. No one's going to get caught. All sorts of guys are doing it. Guys on the other team are doing it. So it's not that I'm condoning anything here. It just seems to me that cheating has been a part of baseball for 140 years, and it was rampant at the time. And to punish two guys for doing it when all sorts of other guys were doing it just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Now, if anyone doesn't vote for those guys, I totally understand. the other side to this issue. But I personally would feel like a hypocrite for not voting for somebody when I know what was going on, or now we all know what was going on at that time. And I'm just not going to punish somebody for doing something that seemingly a whole lot of other people were doing, and people weren't even checking on it back then.
Tim, there was a point, I think it was a game I was doing at Wisconsin with Jack Ham and Ira Miller, who's one of the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And it's a different, you know, it's a different criteria, different way of doing it, I understand. Came in and he said, "Hey, Jack, let me ask you something." He said, "If Ray Guy's name comes up, a punter, who's a contemporary of yours, and Jack, hey, I'd vote for him in a heartbeat." So a specialist. Essentially, Mariano Rivera is a specialist, and you can claim maybe that the DH with Edgar Martinez is a specialist. Are we now seeing that line being blurred from specialist to everyday player or every rotation player?
Yeah, I think we're starting to differentiate a little bit here, and with Harold Baines going into the Hall of Fame and Frank Thomas a few years ago and David Ortiz on his way, I think we're looking at things a little differently now, and I've always looked at Edgar Martinez as a Hall of Famer, but I'm just not going to punish someone for taking advantage of a rule that was in the American League during his entire career. If there had been no DH, he was fully capable of playing third base or first base. He might not have been particularly good defensively, but we have a lot of subpar defensive players in the Hall of Fame because of the offense that he brought. So, yes, and with closers, you know, Trevor Hoffman's in. We've got Moore probably on the way. So I'm not going to agree that a closer is a punter, even though Ray Guy was unbelievably good. But I disagree with that, but I'm also not going to listen to people who say that the closer role is completely unimportant and the last three outs are like any other three outs of the game. They're not. And I think Mariano Rivera proved that, and I think he's going to do a lot to get other closers eventually into the Hall of Fame.
I completely agree. I mean, to me, if you're important to winning the game and you're the best at doing it, I mean, that's how I've always felt. We're in an era now with so many playoff games. I mean, Ted Williams played in 7 postseason games in his life in 1 World Series. Willie Mays never hit a postseason home run, for example. What is the postseason to you if you've got a couple of candidates really close? Is it a separator or not?
Well, it still is to me, within reason. To say Ted Williams wasn't a good postseason player, it's ridiculous. He didn't have enough of an opportunity to do that.
Right, that's my point.
Willie Mays. With all of these games that we play today, I'm going to put increased emphasis on greatness in the postseason. And yet, I also totally understand that when Bernie Williams and Mickey Mantle have the same number of career homers in the postseason, I believe it's fairly close, there's just no way that Bernie Williams was as good a player postseason or regular season as Mickey Mantle. And I love Bernie Williams. That's not the point. The point is you have to factor in how many games these guys get to play in the postseason today compared to Mickey Mantle's time when you won the pennant. You played 4 games and the postseason was over. That's how it works sometimes, especially with the Yankees. So all sorts of factors go into that. But, yes, I am still, if I see a guy who's great in October and the rest of the numbers are good, I'm going to give him some extra credit points for doing it when it matters the most.
Right, and that's exactly my point about postseason back then to now. Williams never got a chance. Mays barely got a chance. Now we have so many of them, I think it gives us a better sample size.
Yes, absolutely. And again, this is also not like basketball where LeBron James touched the ball on every possession and therefore affects every game way more than a center fielder can, who might get 4 at-bats and not even catch a fly ball. So let's understand that just because you don't win the World Series as a baseball player, I'm not sure you should be punished for that, because it's such a team sport and there's only so much that one player can do.
Yeah, look, people don't realize how fragile winning is sometimes, I swear. Thanks so much, Tim. I appreciate your time. It's a lot of fun talking about this. It's always great to have you on. And again, the people up in Lycoming County loved having you up there earlier.
Well, thank you, Steve. I'll talk to you soon. I'll see you soon, hopefully.
I hope to see you soon, too, Tim. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
The outstanding Tim Kirchen joining us. Again, that's I pointed this out several times. We talked about this. I think we are now in an era where, because of the expansion of playoffs, and we are now up to what is the 50 years of expansion in baseball. 1969, it was the Royals, the Seattle Pilots, now the Brewers, the San Diego Padres, the Montreal Expos, now the Nationals, which then brought the leagues to 12 each, 4 6-team divisions, and an extra layer of playoffs, albeit it started out as a best of three. It started out as a best of five. Which then slowly but surely expanded to a best of seven. And now, of course, we've got that best of five divisional round after a one-game playoff. We have so many games now that when you say, well, he's right. He's hit as many home runs as Mickey Mantle in the postseason. Mickey Mantle only played World Series games. That's all he played in. So his 18 home runs were in the World Series. That was it. But while Mantle was playing in the World Series, all right, Al Kaline wasn't. Because Al Kaline was in the American League and only the Yankees were going to the World Series. Kaline got to the 68 series. That was it. Performed well, by the way, but late in his career. So it's a different ball game now. You know, now you have so many postseason opportunities. And, you know, not every postseason's great. In 2013, everyone remembers David Ortiz in the World Series hitting .687 against the Cardinals. Well, in the American League Championship Series, to get to the World Series, he had two hits total. One of them was the grand slam in the ninth inning to tie the game up in Game 2 and get it to extra innings where the Red Sox won. Because he hit that homer. Oh, he only had two hits the whole thing in the American League Championship Series. So you could have a mediocre series here or there, or you can, you know, or you can have a great playoff run or consistently be good in the playoffs. And people remember that. All right, we will come back with more in a moment as we continue on News Radio 1070 WKOK, brought to you by our great friends at Sunbury Motors. Interesting, when you look at some of the great players of the past that should be in, a couple names that were brought up to us, Dick Allen, Bobby Gritch. It's interesting that Harold Baines' selection, not election, but selection to the Hall of Fame has brought up some interesting, like, where's the bar here? And if you said to me, who would you rather have in your lineup, Harold Baines or Dick Allen in a key spot, right? I'll be honest with you. I've never been one that, when Harold Baines was facing my team, I went, oh, boy. Harold Baines is up. Never. Now, did I think Harold Baines was a good player? Yeah. But I didn't sit there as a fan and go, oh, boy, second and third, two out, Harold Baines is up. Oh, man. I never felt that way. Never. Not once. Now, Dick Allen came up and be sitting there going, man, this guy could drive the ball to kingdom come. Even in a game where his team's being dominated, he can ruin it for you. Roger Maret was pitching for the Red Sox, and he carried a no-hitter into the seventh inning at Fenway Park, and my grandfather and I went to the game together. And my grandfather and I love going to games at Fenway. And we went to the game together. We were sitting on the third base side. Roger Maret and the Red Sox, they win the game 4-0. Maret throws a one-hitter, and that doggone Dick Allen went out there, and he got an infield hit. An infield hit was the only hit in the game. It was for the White Sox. But if he came to the plate, I always felt like, okay, oh, good, the bases are empty. He can only produce one run. Or if there are guys, I'm like, oh, brother, here we go. I felt the same way about Bobby Gritch. I felt Bobby Gritch, whether he was with the Orioles or with the Angels, when he came to the plate, I always thought, oh, boy, not exactly the guy I want to see up there right now. And with all due respect, obviously, a guy with 2,700 hits in his career, I never felt that way about Harold Baines. So if you gave me a choice, I had to pick two out of three, Baines, Gritch, Allen. I'd pick Gritch and Allen before I pick Harold Baines. And again, I'm not trying to put down Harold Baines. 2,700 hits is 2,700 hits. I got it. But for whatever reason, I never got that, uh-oh, here we go feeling. All right, here's Harold Baines up. How are we going to handle this?
Sunbury Motors Hyundai has the brand new Hyundai you deserve with savings of over $7,000. Buy a $25,000 2018 Santa Fe for only $18,259. That's a savings of over $7,000. A 2018 Hyundai Elantra is discounted to an unbelievable $14,810. Sunbury Motors Hyundai has a 2018 Santa Fe Sport that was $34,890 and now only $28,840. Hyundai comes with America's best 10-year 100,000-mile powertrain warranty. No matter what size SUV you're looking for, Sunbury Motors has it. 2019 Hyundai Konas, only $23,210. 2019 Hyundai Tucson, only $21,110. 2019 Santa Fes, only $26,775. And the 2019 Santa Fe XL starts under $30,000. Now is the time to get the new Hyundai you deserve. From Sunbury Motors Hyundai in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Our thanks to Tim Kirkshen, who joined us in the previous half hour to talk about the Baseball Hall of Fame. Now let's turn to one of our Hall of Famers, and that is Tony Knopp. Tony, welcome back. It is always great to hear you on the other end.
Yeah, Happy New Year. Haven't heard you guys since last year now.
And you know what? We're a year better now.
Exactly.
All right, I want to get to the – obviously, there's a lot of area to cover here. We've gone through the college football playoff. You and I discussed before the teams were even announced about 4 versus 8. Now that they've gone through the 4 experience of this particular year, the 2 semifinal games and the championship game, is there a stronger feeling or is it the same feeling about going 4 to 8 among those who control money?
The corporate sponsors want to go to 8. We know that for sure. We've had these conversations with them. The ones who control that side of the money want to go to 8. From what I'm told, it depends on who you're talking to at what conference. Some conferences are healthier than others. Jim Delaney's been one who's been a little bit more diplomatic with his desires, and he's actually seemed to move towards expansion now for the Big Ten. Whereas, you know, the Pac-12, Larry Scott is—he just doesn't have any political capital right now. They're not doing well economically. They're out there trying to raise some money from a private equity fund, just so they can try to keep up with the Big Ten and the SEC. So, given those factors, I think we would actually see that speed up a little bit more, because it's creating an economic rift that's going to make it difficult for, you know, other conferences to compete. So, you know, as an example, if you play in the SEC, you receive a $15 million distribution every year because of your network deal. The Pac-12 does not get that $15 million, or $15 million more than what the Pac-12 gets right now.
That's right. You're
creating a haves and a have-not. And so, and the ACC has the same problem, and the Big East is having the same problem. So I wouldn't be surprised if we see that actually speed up a little sooner. I didn't realize how bad a shape the Pac-12 was in until this all got leaked out. But they've basically gone out to private equity money with a deck laying out exactly how bad it is for them. And I think it might be in the interest of the SEC, the Big Ten, you know, the conferences that are successful in football, to make sure that they're keeping the competition afloat.
And that is something I've talked about before, maybe not specifically with you, but the fact is that the Big Ten and the SEC have absolutely separated themselves financially from the other three conferences. Why is the Pac-12 in the shape they're in? Because I don't care what Bill Walton, he could talk about the Conference of Champions all you want, and no offense, you can win all the swimming titles at Stanford you want, but people care so much about football and basketball, and right now the Pac-12 is not really a competitive conference in either.
No, and you know, people care about football and basketball, but football is still four times the size of basketball. March Madness is a wonderful business experience for everybody. There's a ton of money, a multi-billion dollars. But if you're looking at the athletic departments and how they're allocating funds, you know, at any one of these major schools, football is anywhere from two to six times the allocation. And when you're talking about teams like a Clemson or an Alabama or an Ohio State, you know, teams who are spending anywhere between $39, $40 million a year and $80 million a year, now we're talking about a $15 million per year difference. Right, there are teams that have been in the playoffs that are doing it with $38 million a year budgets, and they're receiving a $15 million advantage payment that you're not seeing if you're in the ACC, if you're in the Big East, if you're in the Pac-12. And the problem you're running into out here on the West Coast is at least in the Big 12, at least in the SEC, or I'm sorry, the ACC and the Big East, you have programs that are thriving. In the Pac-12, you really only have USC and Oregon thriving, and Oregon's thriving because of private money coming from Uncle Phil. So they signed a terrible television deal, a television deal that basically gave away their rights to, you know, sell to the sponsors that they want and really get the expansion that they want. So while these other conferences expanded into markets that would create more media rights and more sales, it's why, you know, Rutgers is in the Big Ten now. You know, the Pac-12 expanded into Utah and Colorado, which are not major media markets. Neither one of them is in the top 30. Salt Lake City and Denver don't move the needle. So I don't know what the answer is, but people wonder, you know, what happened to the Pac-12 when it comes to football and when it comes to basketball. And basketball and football, it's the TV deal. It's the Pac-12 network. The conference has been so poorly run that you're starting to see on the court there's just no real contenders. I mean, the Pac-12, if they didn't have an automatic bid, probably wouldn't even get a team into the basketball tournament this year.
Exactly, and that's part of the issue. Again, when Penn State played Washington last year, Tony, I know it ended up being a 7-point game, and I thought, no offense, but Penn State's not just better; they're a lot better than Washington, and that it played out that way. Why? Yes, the Big Ten Network makes a lot of money for the Big Ten. SEC Network, courtesy of what ESPN puts into it, is doing fine. Why hasn't the Pac-12 Network caught on the coast? And is it really, I mean, you're around the Dodgers all the time, so I guess should we be surprised by that?
You know, it's not so much the ratings. The ratings are okay. And Larry Scott, the one thing you can defend Larry Scott on is Pac-12 After Dark. The coaches hate it. So I don't know how many listeners actually pay attention to Pac-12 After Dark out there, because the game started 11 o'clock Eastern time. But the idea being, we're going to be the only show that's currently on. And it actually, the ratings have been okay for that. But everything else just hasn't translated. You know, the Pac-12 was predicated on, you know, major teams in specific markets that were starting to create some kind of national interest, right? So you and I remember when Washington was good for a very long time. You know, Washington's been good for a few years, the last 3 or 4 years. But for the decade before that, after Willingham had them, they were terrible. And they weren't driving anything in what is basically the Pac-12's number three media market and nationally known team. Cal and Stanford haven't been in the conversation, between a few blips here and there. And then, you know, look, the bedrock of the of the conference when it comes to football is USC. And USC football hasn't been relevant in years. So that's a problem. And what I think, what I'm really concerned about happening, is I think USC is just going to leave the conference. There's no reason for them to stay.
Where would they go?
I think they'd have to go independent. They'd have to try to follow Notre Dame's lead and go independent when it comes to football. Every other sport, they're not, you know, they have a lot of championships when it comes to water polo and a couple of other, you know, non-revenue sports. But the revenue sports, you know, they're not basketball-wise. They've got a beautiful new venue that they half fill even when the team's good. But when it comes to football, if they can get their own network deal, if they can create their own scheduling that would be more national, it makes a lot of sense for them to be able to go out and schedule. You know, they already play Notre Dame, but, you know, you want to replace those games against Colorado, Utah, you know, Oregon State, games that just are not driving any national interest amongst recruits or anything else. If you can replace those with some, you know, trademark games like Notre Dame, now you're in business. You know, people a lot of times talk about how Notre Dame and Swofford and what they've done there has made it very difficult for the football team to compete, but the football team's been in the final game or in the CFP twice now in the last 5 years. And if you look at what they're doing revenue-wise, they're able to compete with the major conferences.
And with something, there's another element that adds into this that I think people should realize. There will be no state pressure on them to make a decision because they are a private school.
Private school, yeah. They call their own shots. There is no state funding in anything. They own the Coliseum outright. When the Coliseum went broke, they bought it outright, so they own it. They're doing the renovation on it with their own money. It's one of those situations where if you're sitting in charge at USD, if you're Lynn Swann, you know, you've got a $15 million deficit right off the bat between you and Clemson and Alabama and Penn State and all these teams that you were competing with 4 or 5 years ago.
Right.
If you can bridge that gap almost automatically by saying, we're not going to play in the Pac-12 for football anymore, we're going to go do our own TV deal, and we're going to replace Utah, Cal, and, you know, Oregon State and Washington State with three, you know, we'll play a cupcake and then we'll play three well-known non-conference teams, you make up that $15 million pretty quick.
Yeah. Interesting. What does it mean to Los Angeles that the Rams made the Super Bowl?
Not as much as the NFL would like you to think. It's really not. This is the funny thing about what's happened over the last week with, you know, the controversial calls in both games and teams getting left out. And I'm curious what the statute of limitations is on this. We saw that the Saints are suing. Some fans are suing the league. So, hey, look, if that actually goes through, one of the Sacramento Kings is going to sue the NBA. But what's really
exactly
happened here
for
was
game
they
seven.
Needed the Chiefs in that game, and they needed the Saints in that game, but they really, really needed the Chiefs in that game. The NFL owns a company that they've poured a ton of money into, you know, in partnership with a bunch of investors, including Jon Bon Jovi, where they sell tickets to the Super Bowl. So they've actually taken them back from the teams and back from brokers, and they sell them themselves. That company announced a month ago that they're on the block, that they are for sale. Right, they're kind of pretending that they didn't, but they made sure there was an article written, and they put out a price that nobody would pay, $800 million. And they really needed a strong Super Bowl, and the Rams is not a strong Super Bowl. The Patriots will do okay, but the Rams is not a strong Super Bowl. And even when you're looking at the playoffs here, you know, the assumptions and the guesses that they're making out here are that, you know, 35% of the building is competitive fans, even in the championship games. So when you're in the division game against the Cowboys, it's over a third Cowboys fans.
Obviously, the stadium is still a year away. They're going to have to play another year in the Coliseum. Is there excitement in Los Angeles, the number two market, about this? Or
no.
Would there be more excitement about the Dodgers? I mean, or, you know, or LeBron? What is it?
A lot more excitement about the Lakers than there are the Rams. You know, the pecking order here, you know, you've got pretty clear pecking orders everywhere you go, right? There's Penn State territory, there's, you know, Michigan territory, there's, you know, here the pecking order is very clearly Lakers first, right? That's what everybody right. wants. It's a Laker town. It used to be a Dodger town until the strike in 1994. Up until that strike, the Dodgers had 32,000 season ticket holders. After the strike, they had 8,000. The highest they've ever been since has been 14. So they never wow. they never came back from the 94 lockout. You're looking at the Rams, the problem they're having, so they're actually, believe it or not, doing pretty well selling the premium inventory, right? Their suites are doing okay. So if you look at Las Vegas is selling their suites on 10 and 15-year deals. They have 96 suites to sell. They've sold about 60 of them. That's not very good, right? You only have 2 years left till the stadium. You want to be about 75, 80 suites sold. LA's doing better. Because, you know, and they're doing 20-year deals. So the corporate money is coming here, which is why the NFL made the move. The problem is the NFL has to try to convince the rest of the country that LA cares. And if you look at the stadium during the games, they kind of don't. You know, their big showcase game was the night game against the Kansas City Chiefs, and they sold it out and had 75,000 people in the stands. You and I know the Coliseum fits 90,000 people.
That's right.
Right. The yep. sellout of yep. 75,000 wasn't a sellout. You tarped off 15,000 seats. USC right. sells 90,000 tickets. So they're trying to tell this story nationally. I'm not sure how well it's taking. In Los Angeles, we know it's bogus, right? We know if you want to go to the game, you can buy the ticket on the secondary market for cheap.
And not only that, but it does not take much to have an ear to listen and know that a good chunk of the crowd is actually there for the other team.
Chargers games are sometimes almost 70% the other team. I mean, it's worse than the TV makes it look and sound. Rams games, yeah, it can be between 30 and 50%. When the Eagles come during the regular season, it's 50% Eagles fans. You can see it in the pictures.
Okay, well, now I want to flip it over to the Chargers because you talked about what they're selling there. Are the Chargers selling at all when it comes to their suites for what will be their half of the games in the new stadium?
Well, they're getting packaged in. They're trying to do, you know, the way the Giants and the Jets did it when they split their stadium is they both were responsible for their own sales. And
right.
You can imagine, anybody could guess who outsold the other one, right? The Giants outsold the Jets, right. 2-1, 3-1 level.
Right.
You know, the Jets do fine. It's a major market, but nowhere close to as well as the Giants do. This is that on steroids. The Chargers have already cut their prices by over 50%. They've cut the PSLs. You don't need to sign up. So you don't have to pay the personal seat license anymore, which is the right to buy your season ticket. There are a lot of rumors floating around that, you know, they're actually going to move the team, quote unquote. I just can't believe the NFL would do that in this short period of time already. But they're not selling out a 26,000-person stadium. There's no way they're selling out the 78,000 people that they're going to put in the new L.A. stadium. So I don't know. I don't know. Goodell's got to earn his $45 million a year and figure out what he's going to do because we are 2, maybe 3 years away from a Charger home game having, you know, 40,000 people in the stands.
What, you know, let's get to the rumor part of it because what the heck, that's fun. Where would they be rumored to go to?
London. I mean, the
London.
Obvious choice for London is the Jaguars because the owner also owns Fulham, the soccer team, and
that's
they
right.
just got promoted to the EPL. He put a bid in on Wembley. That's probably going to happen. You know, he's got a footprint there. They make sense to go there. But, I mean, the NFL is going to need to do something with the Chargers. And that's really the only thing left for them to do. People have said, what about Oakland? Well, the Raiders aren't even going to be playing in Oakland next year. The rumor is they're going to be playing at AT&T Park or whatever they're calling it now, Oracle Park. I'm sorry, they changed the name. Where the San Francisco Giants played. Now it's called Oracle Park. So they're going to be playing there next year is the rumor. They're either going to play there or they're going to share Levi's Stadium with the San Francisco 49ers. So you've got the NFL who's just killing it. I mean, 53 million viewers for the Chiefs and Patriots because you have these haves and these have-nots. It's kind of like we were just talking about with college football where the NFL is looking at these teams and they can't get traction, right? The Chargers have no traction. The Jaguars have no traction, but they have to do something with them because, you know, you got to have somebody for the Chiefs to play. You got to have somebody for the Patriots to play.
We're in an interesting spot right now with what some would call an hourglass economy. Where the upper level's doing extremely well, there's money that's filtered, you know, and the lower level, and then there's the middle. Does that affect how corporate partners look at things right now? Because 19's an interesting year that can go either way economically, or does sports blunt that?
No, you know, what's happening on the team side, there's always going to be the super halves, right? Which, you know, a couple of teams that are, you know, generational teams that are going to break the norms, like the Golden State Warriors, and, you know, teams like
sure.
that. There's only a handful of those. What's happening at the rest of the teams is two things. One, term lengths are getting much shorter, which is why when you look at the Rams and see that they're selling 20-year suites, it's pretty amazing. I mean, it shows that there is corporate support for the team. Most other places where you used to be able to buy a suite only with a 5- and 10-year commitment, you're down to 1. I was out to lunch with an NFL team about a month ago who is a top 5 NFL team. I'm not going to sell them out, but major city, a top 5 city. You know, when you're saying these are the 5 biggest teams in the NFL, this is one of them. They have 26 open suites out of the 130 that they have. Just 5 years ago, they had 130 sold, and all of them had wait lists on them. Now they have 26 open. They used to do 5- and 10-year deals open. Now they only do 1-year deals, and you can even buy a partial suite. So that's what's happened in that market is that the buying power has moved to the corporate partner because the corporate partner can now start to dictate those terms. So that's the number one thing we're seeing happening with it. The other thing we're starting to see happen is the mega sponsors are starting to flex their muscle. So Anheuser-Busch last year announced a performance-based sponsorship model. So they went to their teams and said, listen, we will pay you X, but if you make the playoffs, you'll get Y. And it wasn't that well publicized until it really came up at the end of the basketball season last year, where if the Timberwolves got in the playoffs, there was a 20% kicker in their sponsorship deal. And these are big deals. These are anywhere from $1 million to $10 million a year, sometimes higher. And if they won that game, they got the kicker from Anheuser-Busch, and they won the game and they got in. Meanwhile, Miller just dropped the naming rights deal for Miller Park, where the Milwaukee Brewers play. So,
right, I saw that.
It's, you know, and it's happening across the board. AT&T just dropped the rights to AT&T Park. That's now going to be Oracle Park, which means Oracle's probably going to drop the rights on the Warriors' old stadium when the Warriors move to Chase. So it looks like it's just musical chairs. Like, well, okay, Miller left, and now American Family's in. But American Family, I can guarantee you, is paying less on a shorter term with more out clauses, because that's what's been happening with this. There's just more choice for the companies.
These leagues have done a great job of building star power, where it's the name of the star, and you know, LeBron James and the Lakers are facing whatever. Patrick Mahomes and the Chiefs are facing whatever. How do you feel about the ability of how they've used star power, and has it in some ways blunted team power in terms of selling?
It's totally blunted team power. This is my personal opinion, just based on the numbers that I've seen on how business is doing across the different leagues. The NFL has profited so significantly from fantasy football and from the ability to become a little less team affiliated, right? Even though I believe the NFL is more team affiliated than any other sport. You know, the diehards of the Eagles are more diehard of the Eagles than they are of another team.
Agreed.
They've done a really great job of making every game watchable, and their fantasy game is just something that is more understandable for the masses, right? I still love baseball, so I'll listen to Tim Kirchner, and I love, you know, it's a good segment, and I like listening to the guy. Fantasy baseball is a year-long slog every day for 162 days. So their star power equivalent hasn't really changed that much, where the NFL, it has, where the NBA, it has. You know, you're following these teams, and now people are jumping back to back. But what I've really seen happen with these players, and talking to a number of them, is this is how they come up now. You know, you and I were raised in a scenario where you grew up, you went to a, you know, elementary, secondary, and then a high school, and you played right for those. And maybe the city had an all-star team. But that's not the way it works anymore. Now they all play AAU for clubs. And so people say, how can you jump from one super team to another? It's what they've done their entire careers.
Right.
You know, for us, it's the Compton Magic down the street, which if I rattle it off, there's, you know, 20 NBA players that have gone through that club.
Unbelievable.
And so you look at Kevin Durant and you look at LeBron James and say, how can you turn your back on the city? How can you turn your back on something? It's not turning the back to them. That's never been how they played. They jumped from team to team every year. This is no different. And the reality is the shoe money is what's really driving it. So if you look at like half the reason Kevin Durant went to the Warriors is because Nike paid him to. Because the Warriors were an Under Armour team, and with Steph Curry there, Under Armour was getting a footprint, and they needed a Nike athlete in that market. I can guarantee you Kevin Durant was very well funded by Nike to go to the Bay Area.
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt, because it appeared to me he did not take a vow of poverty. So it's...
No. No. It's just like LeBron James or Paul George in Los Angeles.
Oh, God, yes.
Nike's paying for that. Nike needs a staple athlete in Los Angeles. So there you go.
Another amazing half hour. Thank you so much. I cannot begin to thank you enough, because every time you're on, I feel like we're doing 20 to 25 minutes of radio gold.
Ah, it's fun. It's my favorite part. I enjoy Kirchner a lot. I want to hear more of him, too.
I do, too. I mean, he's great, I tell you. And he's about as nice and about as down-to-earth. You know, he's, you know, you like to get as many no-ego guys like you on and him on. It really, I think that they just want to talk about what people enjoy.
It's just amazing what he knows with no notes. He's an encyclopedia. He's forgotten more in the last week about baseball than I've known my whole life.
You and I follow it like all the time, and it's like we're not even close to being at where he is in terms of, you know, what he knows.
Yeah, it's crazy. Amazing. He's great.
Amazing. Tony, thanks so much. Appreciate the time. I cannot wait to talk to you again, my friend.
Yeah, we'll talk very soon.
All right. Tony Knopp. Wow. That was another fun time. Boy, what an hour we had between Tony and Tim.
So when USC goes independent and when the Chargers go to Europe, we say we scooped it here first.
Pretty much, yeah. Well, again,
Chargers to London, I about fell out of my chair. Wow.
But my point about USC is this. I mean, look, they are obviously part of the rudder of the Pac-12. But I think people don't realize they're a private school. So there's none of this, you know, the state of California cannot look at them and say, hey, look, you got to play UCLA, you got to play Cal, you got to play San Diego. Look at them go, no. It can't be like the Virginia Tech, Virginia situation where Virginia was forced by the Commonwealth government of Virginia to vote for Virginia Tech to enter the ACC because the state government mandated it. USC has none of that. So if they ever wanted to go independent, they could. All right, more fun tomorrow. Mark Wogenrich joins us. Chris Trapasso. Dave Seaman from the Washington Post.
Your station for news, weather, business, and CBS Sports Radio. News Radio 1070 WKOK Sunbury and on WKOK.com.